I'll call this meeting of the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners to order. This is Wednesday, January 24th, and we are in the Commissioners' Meeting Room in the Lincoln County Courthouse. First item on our agenda is to establish a quorum. We have all three commissioners present. Next item would be the adoption of the consent calendar, and before I entertain a motion, I have a couple of comments I'd like to make, and if my fellow commissioners wish to add to that, they may do so. First of all, I'd like to recognize the fact that Bill Bain is being re-nominated to the Cascade West Area Commission on Transportation. He's a private sector member, and I've also asked him to serve on the executive committee of that commission. We're also reappointing Linda Roy, who is a Lincoln City business person, as a representative on our budget committee. And last, we are appointing Rebecca Austin as the interim director of the Health and Human Services Department. Are there any other recognitions that the commissioner or comment wish to make?
Nothing to add beyond that, Mr. Chair, so I would make a motion for approval of the consent calendar as presented.
Second.
Been moved and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
That motion carries. We move down to reports, and this is one of my favorite annual reports, but then I'm a numbers guy and a banker, and some people would say that's good, other people would say that's bad, but always exciting to have this annual review, and we know you both, but for the record, please introduce yourselves, and then I look forward to your presentation.
Janice Respeck, Finance Director.
Paul Nielsen, Partner Eisler CPA.
All right, tell us the news.
First, I gotta tell you a joke about accountants.
All right.
Some people tell me this isn't a joke. Maybe I already told you this one, but you know what the definition of an accountant is, right? No. Someone who finds a problem you can't understand and explains it in a manner. If he finds a problem you didn't know you had, already messed up a joke, and explains it in a manner you can't understand.
Yeah.
You got it. Next time, bring back a joke about a banker,
will you? Oh, well, my wife's a banker, Doug.
There are a lot of those out there, too. I've heard many.
Yeah. My wife actually works for the place Doug used to work.
That's right.
So many of you, all of you, I think, have been through this before, these communications we have to do, the audit report, our audit opinion. We actually have several places where we have our letterhead in there, because you have what's called the Single Audit Act, which we've talked about in the past. But our audit opinion at the front is every other place you see a letterhead is really ours, and everything else really belongs to management, even though we draft the report for you. And the front opinion says there's no material misstatements in these financial statements. So what does that mean? It means if somebody were to read these statements and make a decision based on the information in those statements, they would not change their decision based on if there's any errors in there. It would not change the decision. So we had no findings related to this financial statement or the federal awards, no difficulties encountered during the audit, no misstatements detected, but as far as I know, we had no disagreements with management, accounting issues. Management did sign a representation letter. That gets longer every year, and especially since you have a Single Audit Act, there's about a page and a half just related to that. But when they represent things to us related to...
And just to clarify, the reason it gets longer is because of the federal requirements for statements.
Yes, sir. Or even lawsuits. After a couple of lawsuits against auditors, some things get added, yes.
So it's not a reflection of any issues with accounting.
No.
It
gets longer because, exactly what you said, regulations are lawsuits against... After Enron happened, they added several lines to the representation letter.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, you have a clean opinion. And just to remind you, and I actually did a city presentation last night. I actually did City of Warrenton, so I drove down 101 last night and stayed in the hotel here. And so that was interesting in and of itself last night. But we have three bases of accounting. I was talking to them about that last night. Budgetary basis, which is what you need to really look at and concern yourself with. But GASB, the Government Accounting Standard Board, says we have to do the others. Budgetary step-by-state statute, and budgetary and modified accrual, which is what GASB requires for your governmental funds, used to be the same. GASB has been changing the rules for modified accrual, and budgetary law hasn't really changed much at all, so they're drifting apart a little bit. So there could be a little bit of difference there. And then we have to put full accrual statements in your financial statements, too. So there's literally three different bases of accounting reporting in this financial statement. That's why they're sometimes very difficult to understand. And I'm going to borrow Janice's real quick. She didn't know I was going to do this. Just for information purposes, as we talked about the last couple of years, GASB 68. Now, we have all this. We have about 5 pages worth of pension disclosure in here. Just so you know, I'm going to look at page, if I can find the right page here. Next year, since you have what we call OPEB, other post-employment benefits related to your health insurance, a new standard's coming out about that, and you can look forward to about 4 or 5 pages of OPEB financial statement footnotes starting next year. But the actuaries right now, when we did this statement, estimated a rate of return basically 7.5% on the investment. So that made your share of the state pension liability about $6.9 million. And there's a disclosure in here where we represent what's going to happen if it goes up by one or down by one. If it goes down by one, you're up to $11 million. And if rate of return goes up by one, you're at $3 million. And since this statement, they've actually reduced their estimated rate of return from 7.5 to 7.25. So I expect your pension, your share of the pension liability will be higher again next year because they've already reduced their rate of return. So that doesn't affect your budgetary statements at all, but it's interesting to see what your share of what the state liability is.
So I'll ask the question. $11 million sounds like a big figure.
Mm-hmm.
I recognize our general fund is roughly $39, $40
million. Mm-hmm.
How do we mitigate that risk, or how are we mitigating that?
Can I address that, Commissioners?
You may.
Finance Director Janice Riesbeck and I actually attended last week a meeting with about 150 other PERS employers, mostly local governments, districts, schools, counties, cities, to talk about various options you have for dealing with this unfunded liability. And remember, it's not like a lump sum. It's not like you have to pay $11 million tomorrow kind of thing. And there are some options being developed. There are some opportunities. And we got a pretty good feel for it. This is as complicated an area of accounting and law as I've ever looked at in my career. And so we're going to be in the boat with a lot of other employers across the entire state. And I think there are some opportunities. And frankly, we may be bringing you some options and ways to reduce that liability as part of the next budget process. There's some things we can do. So this is something that's being examined on both a state level and then on a local level, and then a lot of groups coming together to discuss how to deal with this.
It's taken a while because this is only your third year that this reporting has been required.
Right.
And I know PERS is finally, I've been aware of all these conferences that have been going on, meeting with people, trying to figure out ways to mitigate that.
Yeah.
So,
well, I think the important thing is again, it's not a lump sum obligation.
Right, it's not a lump sum.
I agree. Hear those numbers. People think that. Oh, boy,
yeah.
You're going to have.
No,
to
it's not a lump sum.
Tomorrow for that? No.
That's actuarial determinations of what's going to be paid to people.
Yeah. And it changes.
It changes.
Indicated.
Yeah.
From
year
to year.
Year to year. It changes all the time. And it is very complicated accounting. I know. It's
very complicated.
Very complicated accounting. So most accountants don't even understand what's going on there.
Well, that goes back to your joke, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So Oregon Minimum Standards. The state of Oregon has statutes. They're called Oregon Minimum Audit Standards. It's interesting. I don't know if you find this interesting, but I've audited governments in California, Idaho, Nevada, and Oregon. And Oregon is the only state that has any statute on what has to happen related to municipal audits. AICPA issues audit. American Institute of Certified Public Accounting issues all the other audit standards. And it so happens, New Jersey is also the only other state that has audit standards by state statute, and we're the only two states in the union where you can't pump your own gas either. So, do I see a trend developing here?
We'll see.
So, deposit public funds. You can deposit your money in any financial institution you want to, up to $250,000, which is the FDIC insurance limit. After that, you have to use a financial institution that is on the Oregon Treasurer's approved list, and we verify that everybody you put your every bank you use is on that list, basically. Debt limitations. Is the county, there's a calculation based on the real market value as determined by the assessor's office, and we do that calculation, and it is only general obligation debt. There's a disclosure in your financial statements about that. And you're not over your debt limit. We do testing of the budget. make sure there's things that are done properly in the budget. One thing the state has really been cracking down on, which fortunately you have not done ever. Apparently there's been enough people budgeting a negative opening fund balance that they've been mentioning it in training now. So I'm just warning you, don't ever budget a negative opening fund balance. Insurance, we are required to look at your certificate of insurance, make sure you have some insurance. Programs funded from outside sources, the Single Audit Act basically covers that. I've talked to you many years about that. I don't intend to do that again this year unless you really want to hear more about the Single Audit Act. Highway revenue testing. So the state passes through gas tax to you, and you can only spend that on certain things. There's state statute that says what you can and can't spend it on. And we test that every year. Make sure we draw a sample and make sure you've spent the money on what the state said you can spend the money on. So you can't just use it to transfer it over to the general fund for operations in the general fund. Investments of public funds. There's things by state statute you can and can't invest in. And fortunately in the state of Oregon, the only state I've worked in that allowed derivatives was California. Fortunately in the state of Oregon they don't allow it, and Orange County went bankrupt many years ago because they invested in derivatives at that point in time. And public contracting. We take a sample of all the contracts you put out during the year, put out for bid, and we test it to make sure you scored it the way you say you're going to score it. Make sure you follow the procedures related to public contracting. General fund revenue and expenditures from transfers for the last 5 years. You can see here your general fund's grown quite a bit in the last 2 years. So it's probably no surprise to anybody here. But it's a pretty good sign that every year the green bar, the revenues, exceeds the expenditures. Then we have now the 10-year days, general fund's days in cash. So to remind you what this is, I take our expenditures for the year on the audit report divided by 365, and if that's your daily expense, how many days could you last as of June 30? And you're up to 105 days now, which is pretty good after being down to 53 back in 09.
It's been a long, hard battle.
It's been a long, hard battle. Then this actually shows the balance in actual cash.
Thank you, Paul. Yeah. That was a slide I specifically asked for.
Yeah, and I've actually got it on all the funds that I show these slides for. So.
All right, good.
So that shows what's going on with the general fund.
So what's that, about 8.9?
8.9, almost 9 million.
9 million.
Yeah,
right. So 9 million. Back on our any balance, or this one too, you can say, there is a standard that you like to see.
I had this
and
question last night.
Is that standard change?
No, I'm still, and it's not really a standard. I've been saying it to everybody, but I've been doing this for, let's say, I got out of college in 83, so now 35 years auditing governments. There's no standard of authority that says that, but I've been doing this long enough. I think if you don't have at least 90 days, you're going to have cash problems, and you probably experienced that when you were below 90 days. Your cash is really tight in that time frame. If you get above 90 days, you're doing pretty good with cash. So if you talk about standards, it's just my own personal opinion. You should have at least 90 days on hand.
Am I correct? I've also heard the numbers thrown out of 15% of your general fund.
That's one we used to use, didn't we, and talk about it?
You're talking about the federal
standard for reserves.
That's different than having the cash.
Yeah.
Right.
Some governments do set their own. I don't remember if you guys have set one, but they set a days limit or a percent limit. There is a budget law about transferring 15% amounts out of contingency. So there is that.
Okay.
This one shows your public health. And it's probably no surprise to anybody here, public health, we only have one year really where the green exceeds the red. That shows your day's cash, and they are actually negative at the end of this year in public health. Now, that might be sitting in receivables because this is just cash. So, and what happens when you won't see a negative cash in these financial statements, because GASB rules say, if you have a negative cash in one fund, they're really borrowing it from another. So we reclassify it as a receivable or a payable to the general fund. Because you have two funds that are on these slides that have negative cash. So if you look at this report, say I don't see any negative cash because we've stuck it in due to the general fund to be in compliance with GASB reporting standards.
Okay. I wondered if we'd have a slide that would
public health
quantify it in dollars.
Yeah, that's dollars. You got a slide for dollars for every one of these. So they have negative $66,000 in cash at the end of the year. And this is mental health. Again, revenue expenditure. And Janice and I were just noting every other year it looks like green exceeds red. So, again, trending. Maybe we'll get green or red this next year with the mental health fund. There's your day's cash in the mental health fund. So still not doing too bad, 143 days. That's doing. And then there's your cash balance.
So I'll go back and ask you a question.
Ask me.
In public health, a lot of times we have a situation where we have a lot of people who don't pay.
Right.
And in business, you can take a write-off on it. But in government, if they don't come up with money, there is nothing you can do.
Well, you're still taking an expense on it, but you know, you're not paying taxes, so they know.
Right.
Yeah, it's still recorded as an expense, but there's not a lot you can do with that. So.
There's a difference in private business and government.
And I believe, isn't public health had some receivables that would help cover this?
Basically, the negative cash is the result of slow, mostly grant revenues. So we book them at the end of the year as accounts receivable, but we haven't gotten the cash yet. We're expecting it, and we do get it in August. Or
do you have any idea what that number is roughly? As an account, I don't need a precise number, but will it compensate for that?
It brought them up to about in the neighborhood of 90,000 plus as an ending fund balance.
That looks a lot better than that.
Right. Yeah.
And I feel confident in delayed grant funding is when, I don't think in the current administration, but in the past when people thought that client revenues that were on the books as receivables would be to our benefit on the bottom line, that caused me to scratch my head, and I'm not a numbers person.
So, again, I think it's important to note that really what we're talking is about, as far as the negative balance, cash balance, is a timing difference.
Timing difference.
The money's coming, it just hasn't gotten here yet.
Right. And with grant accounting, just so you're aware of what happens with grant accounting, like most grants that you deal with, I don't think you have any that aren't like this. They're what we call expenditure-driven. You can't recognize the revenue until you spend the money.
So you've spent
the money. Then the revenue, you recognize it, but it's sitting in an accounts receivable. You haven't gotten the cash till you send that in, they write you a check, and then you get it back. And sometimes it takes, I actually did one audit many years ago, it took them over a year to get a check back from the federal government. So sometimes it takes a while to get your money. Yep. Sounds like you might be familiar with that.
We're all just
been there, done that.
So this is mental health cash fund and cash balance in thousands. Then the community health center. That shows your day's cash, which is, look back in 07 and 08, they had some struggles back then. 07 and 09, but now they're doing pretty well with day's cash. This is your ending cash balance. Any questions?
I'm glad they have the information. It's, the way you presented it, it's easy for the public to understand as well as us. It looks like we're headed in the right direction, and I think we can turn. Hopefully, we can turn things around in the one fund that's in the rears a little bit, and try to get back on the field with the rest of the county. I feel fortunate being in Lincoln County because I know this picture for a lot of the rest of the counties. The state is much
worse.
There are still some counties in the position of being ready to post the sign, the last person out of the courthouse, please turn off all the lights. So, we've had to be frugal, but we're still delivering service.
Well, I think one of the objectives has been to build our reserves, and certainly that presentation shows that we have been successful. And at the same time, while we've been doing that, we've continued to maintain our level of services. We've actually added selectively a few services, and we've still got a balanced budget. So compared to some, we're more than a handful of counties in the state. We're in very good financial shape. So.
Yep.
And it's nice to have confirmation of that.
Exactly. Anything else you wish to...
I did allude to it earlier. And I know it's just probably Janice and I are the only ones that care, but next year you'll be implementing a new GASB and your footnotes will grow.
Again, thanks to the regulatory environment.
Thanks to the regulatory environment. All right.
Well, thank you for
worrying about that so we don't have to.
All right. You're welcome.
Thank you for the good report.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. I'll also note that we're under reports. We're moving to item number two, but we've added a fourth item. I've asked our emergency manager, Jenny Damaris, to offer an update on the distant tsunami watch, which occurred, two nights ago now? In any event, so we'll have a fourth item after we review the other two. And I believe, Commissioner Hall, you have an appointment. You'll need to be leaving shortly.
No, not for an hour.
Oh, not an hour. Okay.
Yeah, medical appointment at 11.
Okay. So. I misread your note.
No, I'm sorry.
I jumped the gun by an hour. Are we ready, Casey? All right. We are waiting for the PowerPoint to be set up. Our next report is from the Housing Authority of Lincoln County. And I see in the audience and coming forward... Joanne Troy,
yep.
Who I believe is the
chair.
Executive Director, Kathy
Codico.
I know Kathy. Our kids grew up together. and, of course, Dustin Capri. So, for the record, please introduce yourselves, and we look forward to your presentation.
Yeah, hi, I'm Joanne Troy. I'm the current Executive Director of the Housing Authority. And to my right is Kathy Codico, who is the incoming executive director. I'm retiring February 15th. So Kathy will be taking over as executive director as of February 14th, I think it is. So, Dustin, you can introduce
yourself. Yeah, Dustin Capri with Capri Architecture.
The reason that we're here today is we have been working for the past year on, just a little background. The Housing Authority, we provide housing assistance in two forms. We actually own bricks and mortar developments that we provide direct housing, and we also manage the Housing Choice Voucher Program, which is generally known as the Section 8 program. A trend that's been happening over the past 5 or 6 years is an alarming mismatch in our demand for units versus the actual stock, the condition of the stock. To give you a little quick synopsis, currently, for example, only 15%, and I'm just talking strictly public housing at this point, 15% of our stock is one-bedroom units, but 64% of our demand is for one-bedroom units. And three-bedroom units comprise 48% of our stock, but only 8% of our demand. So it sets up an incredible disparity in wait times based on bedroom size of units. To address that, we've engaged Dustin. We are going to work on what's called a demo dispo application. The goal would be to dispose of three-bedroom units, specifically single-family homes that we have in the county. These homes would be just sold at straight market value, and the revenue from that would go into building more. It'd be a one-for-one match on public housing units, but the size of the units would be changed. So we're looking to shift our three bedrooms to one bedrooms. And that, in a nutshell, is what we're looking to do. The effects for the county should be positive. In the end, you'll get 20 single-family houses back on the tax rolls as a market rate units. in the short term, we have a 10-unit development. We've already bought a piece of land on Alder Street here in Newport. So we already own that land. So we're proposing 10 units there. And then we're also proposing to reconfigure some of our four-bedroom units into one-bedroom units, because there's another mismatch on that for the demand versus our stock.
So I'm a little bit concerned when you shift from three-bedroom units down, because most three-bedroom units are family units. Am I correct?
Right.
And single units are individuals usually or couples.
Right.
And housing, to me, I'm worried about the family infrastructure when you make the changes down, even though it's only 8%. What's the impact on the family that's searching for a home? I mean, if a single person, it's easier, if you want to call it couch surfing or whatever you want, to find a place to stay. But a family is a challenge. Now, what's the ramifications? You deal with this.
okay, so after our, right now, the disparity is tremendous. 8% of the demand constitutes 48% of the stock. So the wait is just months for the families, which that's juxtaposed to years.
You mean single people, not families?
No, single people, the wait is years. Single people, single people comprise 64% of the wait list, but one-bedroom units only comprise 15% of our stock.
Right.
So the wait is years. As opposed to on the three-bedroom list, the wait is months.
And you're reducing, not eliminating, your three-bedroom stock, correct?
Yeah, we'll still have, even after the proposed change, we'll have 39% of our stock will still be three-bedroom units. And that's, again, matched up against 8% of the demand. So the wait list for families will not be significantly impacted.
So one of the numbers that to me I would ask in this question is the age of the people. There's a lot of that demand. Is that seniors now, that's because of our senior population in this area that is wants the single units? And there again, I'm always worried about youth as well as seniors. I mean, what happens with youth? Is there numbers to show what the changes could bring?
Well, the one-bedroom, to be eligible to be on the one-bedroom wait list, you have to be either elderly or disabled.
Okay.
That's the breakdown of how old they are. I could track that, but we don't. I mean, if you're eligible, okay. You're eligible. They don't differentiate between eligibility criteria whether you're elderly or whether you're disabled.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could, in response to Commissioner Thompson's question, not hard numbers, but just something anecdotal from somebody who works with people regularly, as the Housing Authority does, on housing. Sharon Cox, who's the Housing Case Manager for Community Services Consortium, gets people connected to a lot of housing services. I had a conversation with her not too long ago, just talking about the totality of our housing need, and she said that almost every category is in need, but if she could just wave her magic wand and create housing for one class, one group, she said it would be for single women over 55, because we've got so many widows, so many divorcees who are going into their middle and later years without really good financial resources, and that is the single group in the last few years that she's been seeing on her doorstep on a regular basis.
Okay. And I guess I see it as you're tilting the balance, if you will, a little bit more toward where the greatest need is. But
that's the goal. Yeah. The goal is to, I mean, because these, we started looking at this about 6 years ago, and back then the numbers were, the one bedrooms were only 45% of the demand. It's jumped up to 64. It's clearly growing, and the disparity is increasing. And the length of time, I mean, you can't just wave a wand and make a three-bedroom unit a one. Right. I mean, this is going to take a couple years. This is, you know, it requires, you know, all of the hoops you have to jump through to get HUD to agree to something. So we've started the process. Part of the inception of the process is to come out to the community and to the municipal governing authority. We're actually looking for an endorsement of this proposal because...
And what form could that take? A letter? Or
mm-hmm.
Would you be able to send us maybe a draft and
yep.
put our names on?
Yeah.
Make sure it hits all the points.
Yeah. I mean, it's... there's no question the demand exceeds the supply on all levels, but and you want to balance things, but it's just gotten so skewed that we have to do something to rebalance.
Okay, good.
We thought we'd give you an idea of our concept of rebalancing.
So we're going to, I'm Dustin Capri again with Capri Architecture, and we've had the good fortune of working with Joanne and Kathy on the Alder Street parcel that they purchased. So just as an overview, so what we're able to accommodate are 8 one-bedroom apartments, 2 studios, and, you know, the site has no shortage of challenges, but also a lot of opportunity. We've worked closely with the City of Newport throughout the process, and they've been very willing and able to help us accommodate as many units as we can through various methods. But this is an exterior rendering showing the apartment complex. If you're familiar with the site at all, it's right behind Canyon Way. It drops about 30 feet from up at Alder Street all the way down to Canyon Way. So, you know, a challenge for us was how do we maximize this site? We've had an engineering geologist come out, and he completed a study and gave us recommendations. He confirmed that we can indeed, for lack of a better word, cascade down the hill with these units. That provides us a lot of opportunities for views, but also, and most importantly, allows us to maximize the units for that high-demand one-bedroom category. So this is the exterior shot, and then Joanne, if you go to the next slide.
How do you make it go?
Just the forward over
here.
Yeah, right there. Perfect. So this is another picture of the site. Canyon Way is just to the left right there. There's a parking lot that's owned by the City of Newport. There's also an old right-of-way that goes through that parking lot that was a street that was never constructed. So one way that Derek Tokos and the City of Newport has worked with us is they've allowed us to access half of our parking from that lower old right-of-way, and then the remainder of the parking will be accessed off of Alder Street. It's a site. It's a very tight lot. You can see by the time you take into account all the setbacks, and you can see the topography lines as you're going down the hill. So it's going to be a challenge, and it has been a challenge from the foundation design. But through working with the structural engineer, myself, and then the geotechnical engineer, we're now confident it can be done. And then the next slide, please, Ryan. One thing that's really unique about this site is that, and I wanted to bring this up, is the proximity of the transit opportunities. So one problem that we had on the site is if you applied the City of Newport's parking standards, we would have 2 more spaces, and you really can't accommodate 2 more parking spaces on that site. We were able to go forward with a parking demand analysis, and based on the proximity to these 2 different transit stops, one on Bay Boulevard and one at the museum on 9th Street, we're able to make the case that for a reduced demand in parking, so 1 space per unit. Also, we had a lot of justification there because of the intended users are one bedroom, you know, single occupants. So that was kind of a fun slide to see how it ties into the bigger transit network. And then and a little bit more on that also, if you think about the demographics too that potentially could be using this, I think that really helps for you know, elderly seniors who are living in this who may not have a vehicle. They have, you know, they can increase ridership for the transit, and then also they have that ability to really get all around town from a relatively 5 to 10 minute walk. And this is a section cut just kind of showing how the foundations, how the footings work, how the design's going to fall down the hill, essentially. We were providing two ADA units at the top. All the units will have ADA showers. But from talking to Joanne and Kathy, that's been a big demand, is not necessarily for a fully accessible unit, but for things like grab bars. So all of them will have grab bars. All of them have a shower that can be ADA accessible. Oftentimes, it's not so much the stairs, but the showers that have become an issue. So, and then these are just a couple more renderings, kind of showing the exterior views and the different angles of the property. We're at this point, we're close to being ready to have construction documents, and that's a part of this process, is to, so that Joanne and Kathy can prove, hey, this can be done. We've shown now that it can be done, and then going through their process to get approval. But it's been a really exciting project, and we've really enjoyed working with Joanne and Kathy.
So do you have a timeline, hopefully, to like from breaking ground to cutting ribbon?
Well, we're still probably the better part of a year from being able to break ground. At this point, we have to have the stock that we're selling appraised. You know, we have very strict rules about the acquisition and sale of real estate. So we have to get appraisals. We will be bound by the uniform relocation rules for our existing. We'll have to make sure that we address all of our existing tenants. Our plan is to do that partially through attrition, and then offering, we're obligated to offer them another unit. So that's going to take time. It's kind of like the chicken and the egg situation, because as Dustin alluded to, there is a one-for-one replacement requirement. So when we say we want to dispose of 12 units, we have to be able to prove we can build 12 units. And this site here, although topographically challenging, is a great location for what our goal is. And as you well know, there's not that many R4 sites adjacent to utilities within walking distance of services popping up in the city. So we always joke at the Housing Authority, we own Mariner Heights behind JC Market. If we could just clone that a million times, but you just can't. So we decided on balance that the topographical challenges are offset by the other advantages of this site.
Questions?
It's good to me. Project. Wonderful. Wonderful news.
I might ask just for clarification. I think many times maybe the public misunderstands. The Housing Authority of Lincoln County is really a federal agency. And as far as the jurisdiction of the commissioners, I believe, I mean, we really have no jurisdiction, but we work certainly collaboratively with you in addressing housing needs.
And we appoint your board.
Yeah, they input. The Housing Authority is chartered by state statute. Mm-hmm. Yes, we are an independent authority. As Commissioner Hall mentioned, the point of control, if you will, we have a board of five commissioners that have to be appointed by this board.
But that's the extent of our involvement.
Right.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Good news.
All right.
Been great working with you, Joanne. Yes. Yeah. Looking forward to working more with you, Kathy.
Hey, Kathy, I'll be seeing more of you, kind of like the good old days, huh?
Right. Well, you're in good hands.
Oh, thank you. I've known Kathy a long time. All right, we're waiting again for a PowerPoint change, but next presentation is on the alert wildfire and shake alert warning systems, and it looks like we have some presenters coming forward. And again, for the record, please introduce yourselves and tell us the good news.
My name's Doug Timmy. I'm a professor at Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Oregon.
My name is Leland O'Driscoll. I'm also in the Earth Sciences Department at the University of Oregon and manage the multi-hazards program that we're going to discuss here.
I think think it's going to work. There we go.
All right.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to come here and tell you about what we're doing at the University of Oregon. Both Leland and I are part of the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network. This is a seismic network that's cooperatively operated by the University of Washington and the University of Oregon. It's been in operation for about 30 years or so. We operate seismic stations throughout the Pacific Northwest, and in the past few years, we've been working with our other West Coast partners, Caltech, Berkeley, the USGS, to build out the shake alert system. In addition to that, and I'll tell you about shake alert in this talk, in addition to that, we are expanding our monitoring of hazards in the Pacific Northwest to include other things beyond earthquakes and volcanoes, and in particular, wildfires is one thing that we're looking at. And more recently, even taking a look at the landslide up in Washington using a camera technology we'll talk about today. So in the presentation that I'll give to you, we'll split between the first part of it discussing shake alert and the second part discussing alert wildfire. And if you have any questions, please ask. So the shake alert system is an earthquake early warning system. Again, it's developed by the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network in the Pacific Northwest at UW and U of O and the USGS, and it's also operable in California through Berkeley and Caltech. And I want to give you an example of an earthquake early warning system already in operation. This is the one that's in Mexico that's been in operation for over 25 years. Other countries throughout the world have earthquake early warning systems. Japan has one. Romania has one. Many of those have been built after large earthquakes, and one of the things we're trying to do along the West Coast is build ours out before the next earthquake arrives. And as many of you know, there were large earthquakes in Mexico in September this past year, and what I'm going to show you next is actually from the Deep Focus earthquake, which was closer to Mexico City. And that event, it's probably hard to see here, but it occurred in the downgoing slab on the right-hand side in the yellow areas where the epicenter is located. It occurred closer to Mexico City itself, so the intensity of shaking for the city was significant. And in that area, they have an earthquake early warning system operating. You won't hear the sound on this, but you'll see the building on the left-hand side. Already the people have left. They've heard the sirens that tell them to leave the buildings. And unfortunately, one of the similarities we share with Mexico is unreinforced masonry buildings in the Pacific Northwest. Whether it's our public schools or buildings themselves, these are buildings that we built in the Pacific Northwest before we realized the severity of the Cascadia subduction zone, and many of those buildings will not be serviceable after a large earthquake. I want to point out the applications of earthquake early warning. First of all, simply for people, move them to safety to give some warning. If you do studies after the Northridge earthquake or the Loma Prieta earthquake, you'll find out that there were billions of dollars of health care issues after the earthquake because people found themselves running or in dangerous situations. Maybe they're beneath a fan that comes loose on a ceiling, or they're in a restaurant somewhere. And with an earthquake early warning system, you can give on the order of seconds to minutes of warning so people can duck, cover, and hold before the strong shaking arrives. In terms of things, there's a number of automated controls that can be done throughout our built infrastructure. For example, the BART system in San Francisco already slows the trains using the earthquake early warning system. We're working with ODOT and EWEB to also implement automated actions. In the case of EWEB, they're looking at powering down their generators before the strong shaking arrives so that they can turn those generators on again more quickly after the shaking has passed. And with ODOT, we're looking at whether or not red lights on bridges, such as those here in Newport, would be useful. So very simple things. If we know an earthquake's going to occur and strong shaking's going to arrive within seconds to minutes, stop people from going over some of our historic bridges that are not adequate for strong shaking. And again, situational awareness, real-time operational picture for people to take actions, and also infrastructure to take actions before earthquakes occur. Just so you know how the earthquake early warning system works a little bit, it's not rocket science. Again, it's been around for a number of years in other countries. When an earthquake occurs, for example, along the Cascadia subduction zone, and I'm sure many of you know it extends from Cape Mendocino in Northern California up to Vancouver Island, if that were to go in a magnitude 9 earthquake, it doesn't unzip all at once everywhere. It starts at a position, and the rupture front moves from one location to another. And it moves at about 3 kilometers per second, and it's 1,000 kilometers long. So it takes many minutes for the fault itself to unzip from one end to the other. The first waves that leave an earthquake are the P waves, and that's shown in the second slide, or the second cartoon on the left-hand side. And those are not damaging, and they travel fairly quickly. So by analogy, you might think of a thunderstorm where you see lightning quickly, and the sound comes after a period of time. In this case, the P wave travels out quickly. We record that on our sensors. We locate the earthquake. We estimate its size. And we provide the public a time until strong shaking may arrive. A key aspect of this earthquake early warning system is telemetry, and I'm going to come back to this again and again in this talk, because what we're doing is changing over our telemetry system for the seismic network so that we can transmit high-volume video data for wildfire alerting. Okay, so telemetry is a big part of our system. And the S wave is a slow-moving wave that comes along, and it does the damage. It shakes down buildings and causes harm. And for example, if that earthquake began in Cape Mendocino, here in Newport, you'd get on the order of about 2 minutes of warning before the strong shaking arrived. We provide 5 minutes of warning to Seattle. So the farther you are away from where the earthquake initiates, the longer the warning that you have. And so that's, we think, quite useful. Okay, the major components of our system are, on the left-hand side, sensors out in the field. We have some here in the Newport area. I'll show a map later on of where they are along the coast. The second part of that on the bottom is telemetry, how we transmit that data. Currently, we use a combination of cell phone, internet, satellite, and microwave. And we're trying to switch over to all microwave, and I'll explain why when I come to alert wildfire. That data comes back to us very quickly to our processing centers, and the goal is to send out alerts. There will be a limited public rollout of Shake Alert this year. It's not yet fully operational or fully built out, but we have enough of it built out along the West Coast to provide limited alerts in certain locations, and we're going to be working with various entities along the West Coast to see how they would use our alerts in the future. And as we continue along to full build out.
Can I stop you there?
Yes, please.
So when you say limited, what do you mean by limited? To me, I mean, are we talking a few units? Are we talking the need for more? What's limited mean?
Limited means that we don't have enough sensors in the field that we can provide robust alerts to all geographic locations from all along the West Coast. So if you look on the map on the right-hand side, the black dots are the ones that are stations that are currently delivering data to earthquake early warning. As you can see, LA and San Francisco, because they've got a head start on the Pacific Northwest, they have a much higher station density than we do in the Pacific Northwest. So in those areas, they are pretty much ready to go to provide a rollout to the public for all the faults that they monitor in that geographic location. In the Pacific Northwest and in Oregon, we're behind. So we're trying to build out the number of states, number of sites throughout Oregon and Washington so that we have a similar density. So what we mean by limited is, because it is federal alerts coming out from the USGS, we can't provide robust alerts without false alarms to the public yet. We won't really be able to do that until it's fully built out. And that's one of the goals we're working on, is to fully build out the system. We're about 50% of the way there. What we will do this year is work with our pilot partners, and they are in the hospitals, education, transportation, and
other utility sectors and emergency management sector.
Right. And so we're working with them and saying, okay, we can provide you an alert. There will be false alerts, but there will be actual alerts themselves. So let's start having the conversation of, what does it mean for the public or for these entities to respond to an alert? What are they actually going to do? And so we want some practice with that. You can imagine, if we roll the system out and it's available to everybody right now, we provide false alerts, that's not a good thing.
Okay, that's for the earthquake side of it. On the wildfire side of it, do you still have the false alerts, or is it a direct contact situation?
So I'll speak about the wildfire later on in the talk, okay. But to answer your question right now, where it's built out in Nevada, it's working exceptionally well. It's not yet built out in Oregon, and that's why I'm here and going around to various stakeholders in the state of Oregon. We're really just beginning to build out alert wildfire in Oregon itself. To give an example of that, in San Diego, they put out 12 cameras just in August when they had their red flag days coming up, and those cameras were incredibly useful for watching the progression of the fires and identifying them when they began.
So for me, this is a critical thing for Lincoln County because a lot of people realize the Columbia River Gorge wind funnel was made it capable for flames to jump over the Columbia River, which I just didn't think could even be done.
Right.
And we're in the same wind funnel here on the Oregon coast in the late August with dry conditions, all the right conditions to have a what I call a strip fire right down the coast.
Yep.
And would isolate our communities. And so if you sounds like you have that part detected, so the false signals don't happen as often if we put up the equipment.
So to bear it down now a little bit, the detection of these fires happens in two ways. One is the satellite data provides evidence of lightning strikes, and then you can turn the camera and look at those. To be honest, most fires are seen visually first by someone out walking, and they see some smoke rising. So then you can bring the camera in, and you provide situational awareness to first responders. Do you need to roll steel out to that fire? Every time you roll out to a fire, it costs on the order of $10,000 to $20,000. Has it taken off? How big is it? Is it safe to go into? There is machine learning going on to have computers identify fires themselves, but they've become incredibly useful, and I'll try to point out in the second part of my talk, simply by having visual contact. If someone tweets or calls in on a fire, they turn and look at it. And it turns out because it's available on the internet, all the first responders and all the firefighters have access to this. So when they roll out to the fires now, they oftentimes have an iPad or in the planes themselves, and they use that for situational awareness as they're approaching it. And I can show you at the end of my talk how I can control cameras.
Well, I'll leave the rest of the questions to the end.
Yeah, thanks.
Can I ask about the limited part? Sorry, I didn't mean to.
Go ahead. You go first.
With respect to the limited rollout of the shake alert earthquake early warning system, one primary caution in being sort of careful in the rollout is the mode of delivering an alert message. The system, as we've described, as it's built out, is the monitoring platform. But once an earthquake is identified and the capacity to warn is there, we still need to complete the delivery of that warning from the first warning that comes out of the U.S. Geological Survey server to then disseminate to internal usage or ultimately in a public-facing mode. And that part isn't developed yet, and that's why we're still in a pilot mode to pursue that delivery technology.
And to be clear, that's not our responsibility. That is something that the USGS is working together with the FCC and the telecoms to do. And if you've seen in the news after certain fires in Napa, cell phone towers went down, alerts didn't go out for a long period of time. So we're providing an alert has to be delivered. And it turns out that delivering alerts to everybody is a problem. And delivering geospatial alerts, so it's not blanketed throughout the entire population, but targeted to where the shaking is expected. That is a difficult problem that needs to be solved.
So let me ask you a question about the monitoring sites. Is there a radius that they're effective? Is it dependent on the geology or the particular risk at that point in the fault? How do you determine how dense the monitoring stations need to be?
For the seismic sites, simply, you have an earthquake in a particular location, and you want to have your stations as close as possible so you can get that P wave as soon as you can. So we estimated every 20 to 30 kilometers in the Pacific Northwest. So if you look at, again, that map on the right-hand side, the ultimate build-out of the system includes all the black, yellow, and green dots you can't see, but we're trying to have stations located every 20 to 30 kilometers west of the Cascades, so that when an earthquake begins, we can detect it as soon as possible. Okay. And we need to have right now about four sites detect that event. So it's not just a stationed near the earthquake, but four in that region, so you can locate it and get its parameters.
And you said we're about 50% toward that objective?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's a better map of Oregon. So currently there are 150 seismic stations in Oregon, and we're about 50% funded at present. And the black dots are operating. The greens are stations that are already in the field but need an upgrade on their telemetry so they provide data quickly enough. And the yellow are ones that we're building out.
So the first time we talked about undersea cables.
Right.
And since we have a research cable out here, has there been any progress with University of Washington to be able to? Because if we can detect the P wave from 150 miles offshore, that gives us a lot longer time to react, if I understand right.
Yes. And it's more expensive to do that, as you know.
Oh, yeah.
So there has been progress, but not progress in laying more cable or putting more stations out there. There was a meeting last year at the University of Washington, and it was attended by an international group of scientists. About 150 of us were there. There are cables being put out by the Japanese, and there is interest in other countries. I try and separate those two because right now we're trying to raise the funds for the onshore system, which is a tenth of the price of the offshore system. And the offshore system is a big ask. So that's going to be in the order of $100 million to $200 million to build a seafloor cable offshore. The system onshore is much less expensive.
So the existing cable can't be adapted because we've already got the cable out there.
It can be, but it's only a cable that goes out, crosses over the shelf, and has one site on the subduction zone near central Oregon. There's nothing to the south all the way to Cape Mendocino. And there's nothing to the north until you get to Barkley Canyon up near Vancouver Island. So you'd like to have those along the subduction zone, and we've got one little slice. And yes, there are sensors on that.
So ideally, you'd have a cable that was parallel with its zone rather than perpendicular.
Exactly. Exactly. And the cable that's out there has seismometers on it, and it contributes data. But it doesn't do what we'd like to do, because we don't go this way. All right, thanks for your questions. It's great. I hope I don't take up too much of your time.
Well, if I might take just a second, I mean, kudos to Commissioner Thompson, because I believe he and I both attended a presentation at the Oregon Business Summit where you presented this information, and he identified the opportunities that might lend themselves to some of the challenges we have here in our county. So with that, proceed.
Absolutely. I appreciate that invitation. So the last part of this is alert wildfire. And I think after last summer, many of us know about the problems we're going to have. And really what I want to say about this is that with regards to the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network and shake alert, we're leveraging the telemetry part of it. And we're switching over from slower, less reliable telemetry to 4.9 public safety gigahertz, which provides us a much higher throughput of data. This system is already proven to be very effective in the Lake Tahoe area. We're working together with the University of Nevada, Reno, and Graham Kent's group. He's the director of the Seismological Network in Nevada. And they switched over to microwave a few years ago. And when they did that, partly because Graham had his house burnt over twice, he decided rather than just locating earthquakes, he ought to try and detect wildfires. And so once they got up to the 4.9 gigahertz, which you can see on the left-hand side, you see two microwave dishes that are on the order of 2 feet in diameter. And above that is a pan-tilt zoom camera that allows them to detect wildfires and also provide situational awareness. They've had this operational for the past few years. It's also moved up into northeast Nevada with the BLM funding, and now we're working with Graham to expand that into southeast Oregon. We have BLM funding this year that's going to move their wildfire camera network up into Idaho and out into the Steens Mountain area. And one of the reasons we're here to talk to you is we're trying to make it go statewide. We'd like to have it on the coast and also along the valley. I want to point out that it's going to strengthen shake alert. Some of our sites are bringing back data by cell phone, and the strong shaking, the cell phone tower network is not going to be operational. But if we move all of our seismometers over to microwave, it's a much more robust system, so we can withstand the first shocks and be there afterwards for any aftershocks as well. So it has a benefit to shake alert as well as wildfire detection. This is an example of a wildfire in Cold Springs, August 14th, 2015. If you keep your eye on here, this you'll see in the distance, this fire is going to explode at some point. I think you can start to see the smoke now over the peak. You know, when these are wind-driven, it's important to have this information, not just to detect, but to actually fight the fires themselves. And so many of the, in fact, all the planes that fly into Nevada now use the wildfire camera system to plan their routes when they're fighting fires, and also the firefighters on the ground use this for situational awareness.
What was the period of time that that video covered, roughly? 10 minutes? 2 hours?
Let's see.
Yeah, that's about 15 minutes.
1 minute, 2 minute, 3 minute, 4 minutes, like that. So it's probably about 20 minutes.
Okay.
Yep.
So here on the coast, it isn't so much lightning that's causing the problem. It's literally people.
Yes.
But it's people out in our forest land in that time period, and it's the wind-driven. Our problem is a little bit different in with our dense forest. It skips.
Yep.
It's not uncommon to skip 2 and 3 miles. Well, if you don't get on it quick enough, you've got a chain fire.
Yep.
It can go a long ways in a hurry, and if you look at Bandon, the whole community's burned. And it's been historic to happen. People just haven't seen it in recent years. We've had 2 close fires here just in the last 2 years that could have easily took off and blocked all the coast, and with all the tourists here at that same time, we might be able to get to the beach, which is a place where you're probably not going to burn, but you may be smothered by the smoke if it's bad enough.
Yep.
But we've got our own situation here that's, I think, worthwhile examining, that isn't often seen by the rest of the state.
I agree. So if you had a network of cameras up that could keep track of a fire and also be looking around to see how it skips, it would provide you useful information. I also want to point out you have other hazards here besides earthquakes and fires. You have landslides and other things that are going on that we're not just putting out cameras. We're putting out a backbone that allows us to hook up all different types of sensors and transmit data. So whether it's landslides, earthquakes, or fires, it's a multi-use system. Okay, so the Early Fire Ignition and Monitoring Program, it's functional in Nevada and Southern California. Our mission now is to bring Oregon into this. It's built on meshed microwave IP network. It's more resilient when it's compared to either cellular or fiber transport modes. Because it's an internet-based network, it's accessible anywhere you have a high-speed connection, and I can show you that at the end of my talk. The system has a sustainable business model through early fire detection and savings therein, and we feel that it can provide a hardened environment to shake alert if adopted, and it's a year-to-year public presence through fire monitoring. And what I mean by that is we have earthquakes infrequently in the Pacific Northwest, and how we exercise our interaction with emergency managers is infrequent. But by branching out into other hazards such as fire, certainly over the past few months, we've made a lot of connections with first responders and emergency management groups throughout the state, and we think that has value to it in terms of how we operate in the future. Now, these are old numbers. I think we're almost over 2.7, 2.8 billion in fire suppression this past year in the U.S. We feel like we can save property and save businesses in terms of property loss or impact on tourism. Improved awareness and prevention. The cameras provide actionable intelligence and situational awareness in the case of a fire. And again, it's a shared network. In terms of cost, right now it's between $40,000 and $75,000 per location, with a yearly maintenance fee or maintenance cost of 20%. That price of $40,000 to $75,000 depends on what's available. I know in talking to Commissioner Thompson that you have some towers in the area, and once we have some information on what's on those towers in terms of power or whether or not there's an ability to drop into the internet, we can actually give you a better cost estimate of that.
We have the expertise sitting in the room. Do you want to talk to him?
Yes.
I have to go through the chair. He's the power to be.
I think we should have at least a conversation about what we have so they know, and
sure,
so we can find out what you need. And so who would like to come up? Roy?
Jack?
Jack, any of you that think you want to...
Lieutenant Shanks, all of the above.
Yeah, we're interested in tower locations, you know, what technology is on those locations, et cetera.
Come up and grab a couple chairs, you guys, and we're going to ask you questions.
So I might suggest that the information you're looking for may
Please
be
come
more
on.
Extensive.
Jenny, come forward.
Don't stand back there.
So, Jenny Damaris, County Emergency Manager, and I would suggest with the emphasis of your time of your agenda that the more progressive and productive ways to schedule an actual multidisciplinary meeting with law enforcement, roads, and Oregon Department of Forestry
well,
is here today.
Well, I want to hear some of the base stuff, Jenny, now,
okay,
before we set up a multidisciplinary team, a little bit of the facts, because we don't have all the facts of what sits
right
on the towers and stuff, so
okay,
if it's okay with you,
go ahead. That's fine.
We can go for a few minutes and then go that next step later.
So what would you like to know?
Well, yeah. For example, mountaintop locations that have the potential to have multiple lines to get back to the coast and can see one another in the interior. To what extent there's power available to power the equipment on site?
Okay.
And what locations within the coastal range can we get onto the open internet after making the microwave routes?
Okay. So, probably can't answer that question now, but we have a redundancy multicast simulcast system, microwave system that we have available. I think we have 6 locations in general where we have communication sites. Some of those we own. Some of those we are just a partner on someone else's tower. So like Oregon Department of Transportation may be the owner. We can provide that information for you in more detail. We just did a master communications public safety plan that we have that available. Probably has all of the information that you would be looking for. I believe the majority of all of our sites either have a generator there or they have multi-batteries as backup for that.
Jack, you're the guy that maintains all this stuff. Can you give him any information, so it's base information? Forward.
Again, it's depending on what you need. I mean, I would say out of the 5 that we're on, I think they all have generators. We have one site that's way overpowered. We have lots of spare power on that generator. If I could get a list of what you need, I could give you a better idea of what we're available to give.
I think it's a great idea to have the meeting you suggested. You know, basically for the commissioners, what we need is, as you know, power space is the first commodity. And finding a good tower location and being able to strap something onto the tower is the big issue. Our footprint for our equipment is fairly small, and so there's a size of one of our dishes, and there's a camera to the left-hand side. And if we have to supply our own power, we can put up solar panels if we need to. But really, it's good line of sight towers and being able to put up a dish that size on the tower.
So probably the quickest thing that we could do to help you, because you're wanting to know where those site locations are, we could give you our public safety communications plan that has all of that information, and you could bring that up and GIS it and find those locations and visually look if that would even be an appropriate location.
Yeah.
And then we would determine whether it will indicate we're the owner of the tower or if we're actually residing on someone else's tower, because you would have to partner with them for that
right
particular location.
Right.
Relevant note is that we have an intergovernmental agreement with the Oregon Department of Transportation and the Wireless Division.
Great.
So they say they have similar commentary where there's shared resources
right
on shared
yes
tower locations. And we are not in the business of building new towers, right? It's
right
extremely... It's
you need the rent space.
That's the advantage of this conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
Conversation.
And with input from the county, that really helps us in those scenarios where ODOT isn't the owner and they're leasing from the county, for example. So it's this kind of synergy that will really help to advance the program.
So ultimately, anything, I guess, we have to look at that. But then when the money comes down, since this is experimental, is the people that are putting these in, are they footing the whole bill, or are you working, and do you have the grants available? What's the money side of this?
So there's different options there. And I should probably say, first of all, we're trying to figure that out ourselves. There are a number of stakeholders in the state of Oregon that are interested in this. And it's a little bit different than what I'm used to in the sense that normally I write a proposal to the National Science Foundation or to the USGS. Right now we're going around talking to counties. We've talked to Lane County, Lincoln County. We're working with BLM. We're trying to work with the National Forest Service. We have a call next week with Umatilla Electric, and we're talking to electric companies in Portland. It's a very organic process to build this out. In Nevada, it's done in a couple of different ways. BLM, utilities, some of the more expensive neighborhoods have bought cameras because they want to have a camera looking in their neighborhood. So, you know, we're going to approach, Sun River, for example, would be a classic place to go and say, look, you have a lot of infrastructure, you should protect it. So we're still trying to figure that out, how we work with the counties, how we work with these various stakeholders. And I think at some point it's going to have to be individuals all buy in for a piece of a camera or a camera itself. There are some grant opportunities we're looking at. One came across my desk yesterday, and it's not really for wildfire cameras. It's more for what's called cyber infrastructure. But that has buy-in from local communities as well. So I'll probably come back to you, and I'll probably come back to you, Commissioner Thompson, since we've had an ongoing discussion, and say, here is this opportunity. Would your county be interested in being a partner with us? But, you know, I'd say our hope is that your county would say, we feel like we can contribute towards X number of towers.
So I'm looking at you guys. Is this something you're interested in? You shake your head?
Oh.
I mean, because it's not me that's going to have to do a lot of the work to make this go to the next step. It's you as a team. Do you think it's something
I think anything that we could do for any of the hazards that we face, if we have an early detection system or a way to get that situational awareness that you're talking about with the cameras, giving Oregon Department of Forestry live information that they may not have access to any other way, having a dispatch agency, if you will, being able to be the first eyes when they're relaying the information. The value of information is priceless. The sooner we get it, the more effective we are in our response, and the less recovery we have to do.
So, since the Oregon Department of Forestry is here, do you have any comment?
So we do have
Please come forward so we get it on the video.
So as an agency, mostly in Southern Oregon and Douglas County, we do have a camera detection system. Mostly Douglas Forest Protective Association is kind of sponsored that, or you guys were...
I know of it, and while they're both camera detection systems, that's a T1 microwave that's at capacity, and I've spoken with people who are familiar with it, and they recognize that that's a Pinto and this is a Cadillac.
Yeah, I'm a fire guy, I'm not a technological guy. So,
it's actually been one of the things we have sort of to work through is whenever we say wildfire camera detection, we say Douglas County, we know about the ODF network.
Sure.
And it really is a decade or two technology. It's also a commercial technology. One of the aspects that BLM likes about us is universities tend to be a little less expensive than a commercial entity. And again, the technology is just night and day. For example, this is a live view of a camera in the Sierra Nevada that I can control from here.
Wow.
And, you know, hopefully it has enough internet bandwidth. Now, shaking it, it's in the wind.
Yeah.
Right? But you can see the ability. This is outside of Lake Tahoe.
Here, I thought they were having an earthquake.
So I will say, our detection system, it doesn't have these features. They're basically on towers, you know, all over the high mountaintops, and there's a in the DFPA office, they've got a dispatch room that there's three or four people that that's what they do for a day, a daily job in the summer is watch the cameras, and they go through. They do pop-up alerts and that kind of stuff, but we don't have the interactiveness and like this stuff.
You don't have one in Lincoln County.
We don't have one in Lincoln County. Right. We
okay,
have
I want to
one.
Make sure that we're yeah,
not talking what's now replacing the Pinto with the cat. Starting out with the cat.
Correct. Right. So what we do have for the West Oregon District is we have one camera currently on Prairie Mountain, which is in Lane County, but it does look into Southern Lincoln and Southern Bend.
So can I ask you this question? You can't speak for a department or something, but will you go back and check to see if they're interested in being involved in some kind of a partnership in Lincoln County to do this?
Sure. Yeah, and you know, if Jenny sets up a meeting, you know, with the interdisciplinary partners, you know, we'll be at the table.
Sheriff's Department, you interested?
Yeah.
Excellent. One last thing I want to add about the ODF-ness. You mentioned they have people in a room.
Sure.
This is on the internet, right? So you would have your own credentials to log in and control cameras. So it's something that you don't have to offload to three people in a room that might be on a coffee break, right? You have something you want to look at. Maybe you want to look at your tower, and maybe there's some issue locally that's, you know, separate from fires. Is all the stakeholders who buy into this have their own login credentials and can go and control the camera, and it's useful that way.
For the record, could we get you to identify yourself?
My name is Matt Thomas. I'm the unit forester for Department of Forestry in Toledo.
Thanks. So, we recognize you, Matt. Yeah. Wanted it for the record.
Yes, so that's one question to Wayne before, because you're the one that handles our budgets and things like that. Would you mind if I was involved with this to make this happen so we have some
What I was hearing here is that the contribution we can initially make is we've got towers.
Yeah.
We've got potential sites that we can get the equipment up and running soon. It sounds like, again, our towers are only a beginning part. You actually have a more extensive network you're probably going to want to look at beyond that. And that's when you start really getting into the money. It's when you talk about new towers. I mean, we spent, and the sheriff's office was excellent at getting funding to do towers, but we've built this network over years to get even the six towers we've got now. So this is not a cheap process. But I think in terms of Commissioner Thompson, answer your question, in terms of immediate help and immediate, you know, I won't say boots on the ground, cameras on the towers, whatever you want to call it, we've got some options to work with everybody. So yes, things we can do.
We're not looking to build new towers.
No,
we're looking to put infrastructure on existing towers,
yeah.
And our goal is to go statewide, and we would like, I mean, if possible, we'd like the county to buy in to put in cameras on towers that they own.
Yeah, so we definitely in that sense, you know, we've got towers that we can talk about.
Yeah,
wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a person that doesn't like to sit around and wait, and so when do you think we could put together a multidisciplinary team? When do you think we could get down to moving?
So I think the first step would be is to give you the information of what our tower sites are, give you a little bit of time to evaluate that. We can send an introduction email to those partners that we would want to participate in those conversations, and then look at that availability, so maybe 3 weeks. That would give you time to look at the information, schedule something within that three-week window.
Sounds great.
And we really have a model of location design. I mean, we do have some seismic sites on towers, so we already have a sort of a crude construct in mind. So we'd want to just move there.
Can I ask
lines of sight?
Maybe a follow-up, because I think the focus with the towers is really on the fire. I mean, it can be both. You indicated it can be both, but if the seismic, you know, other locations you're talking about aren't dependent on going on towers, but maybe just having public properties or buildings or locations where the tower or where the seismic might be, and they don't have to be up in the air necessarily. You know, we've got other facilities. We've got microwave links right here in the courthouse. You know, and some of our other partners have facilities and locations that might actually expand the seismic thing that we can look at beyond. I think we were focusing the towers on the fire, you know, ability there. But there's other locations we might be able to talk about that would help with the seismic.
So I guess I'll pursue Commissioner Thompson's thoughts. First meeting is great. What's a timetable maybe to have some feedback as to, you know, what the long-term objective might be, both fire, seismic, and some costs, so that we know what we might do to start moving forward with actually creating that structure.
So what I'd suggest is we talked on the phone last week and scheduled this meeting this week, so we respond pretty quickly as well.
All right, and, so we've got a good time frame
you,
there.
You can send the information. We'll look at it.
Okay.
We know what we need to put on towers, and so what we'd like to know is tower location, power availability, what sort of data drop capability is available at that tower. And we'll look at that fairly quickly.
Okay.
And we'll get back to you fairly quickly because...
And we can schedule a meeting sooner.
And we could probably be out here once we have that information. When we get it, we'll schedule a meeting. It'll take us just a few days to look at it.
Yeah.
And we'll be out here within a week or two to follow up on that.
So, like a month time frame generally? To
My hope would be that we would be able to make a rough estimate for each tower what it would cost to put infrastructure on that tower. And that is going to depend on what's available at that tower and whether or not that tower can get back to drop data into the internet. I want to, maybe it's a nuance. Eventually, we'd like to have this network built out over the state so we're not dependent on the internet. That we're hopping from tower to tower via microwave. It's very robust, so if there's an emergency, we can get data back. But as we start building this here in in southeast Oregon, on the coast, or in Umatilla, they're all going to have to drop into the internet for now until we get that system built out everywhere. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. So let me mention thing. We represent Lincoln County and people of Lincoln County.
Right.
By July of this year, chances are we'll have warm conditions that can set our forest off. I'm looking at the Forest Service. It's usually from that on. And that's my schedule of when I would like to see something done. Now, the challenge, of course, is once we figure out what it costs, and then we go after the money, and we've been pretty good doing those kinds of things. I'm looking at Wayne. We have opportunities. We have economic development funds, which is a small amount of money, but
right.
It can be brought part. One of the things we may have is we may even have some of the equipment you need. I did some work on this kind of thing with Japan that was on our property. We have that equipment stored.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of things that we'll bring to the table, hopefully to make the cost fit with what you want to do.
Great.
And remember, our goals for Lincoln County, your goals for the state. But my experience is if we build it in Lincoln County and get it up and running and it looks like it works, the rest of the people follow.
Yep.
And it's happened over and over and over again.
Yep.
So in our case, we'll try to be the leader and hopefully help you
Great.
Then build out the rest.
Great. And I recognize that's certainly one of the things that limits time is getting the cost and finding the money. The other thing is probably getting on the tower and having an engineer sign off on putting something on the tower takes time.
Okay, I'm going to ask the planning department. Do you get involved in any of this at any point in planning?
I'm coming up front.
Yep.
While he's coming, can I say we've already gone through planning for the location?
All these guys got scored.
That's all been done. That's all been accomplished. No
okay. We're not going to talk very long, Arnold. Do you have any
still
potential impact in this?
You can't get
don't relax.
Arnold, using your humble planning director, it's typically when you're accessing a tower location, there's a conditional use that's already been granted for that tower. So very often you don't even need to amend the conditional use to do it. In the event that it's a sizable change in terms of the tower, we'd require a conditional use permit. So I see that as a minimal deterrent to anything here that should be very doable. But it's going to be based on technical specifications, tower space, who owns it. But, you know, when we've been involved with the development of the wireless network, you got Euchre Mountain, you got all these tremendous, outstanding locations that have tremendous line of sight. Okay. So I think you're going to have a very favorable outcome.
Okay. Good answer. Problem.
Thank you.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
All right, we'll turn back.
Just so you know, there's a history here.
I gathered that. So we'll turn back to you, Doug. I'm not sure where you're at in your presentation.
I'm done.
Okay.
Can I add one other minor detail we haven't covered? Commissioner Thompson asked about to what extent can we deploy the equipment. We discussed funding sources. So two of us in our labs are certified climbing and fall protection. So we have a skeleton crew right now that can install this equipment at the moment, and through this effort we're looking to expand our personnel and expertise base to cover a larger area. So we are sort of field ready at the moment is the point I would like to make.
That's what
we'd
like to hear.
Great information. We'll look forward to a follow-up sometime in February, it sounds like.
Well, Commissioners, this would be the time frame. How about if we just schedule, we'll come back and do an update on March 14th. That gets not enough time for things to happen, because there's obviously it's going to take a lot longer than that. But how's that sound?
That's a joint session with Yellow. It might be a place to have the conversation, because they have a real problem down there.
Well, that's one of the areas, one of the towers is actually located right down there.
Mm-hmm. I guess I would leave it to staff to work
out. We'll work either the 14th, maybe the 21st.
If you can work with your schedule, too, through our staff.
I know March 14th and the weeks after that are unavailable. I'm leading a field trip somewhere. But the week before, that's okay.
The 7th, then?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. We can just give you an update wherever we're at.
Okay, great. Great information.
Thank you for your time.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And a quick response.
Yep. And again, it was Commissioner Thompson that I think initially had a conversation back in December with you.
Actually, we started talking 2 years ago.
Okay.
Well, I've given a couple of talks, and each time I get some really pointed questions from a commissioner from Lincoln County, to be unnamed.
Very good. And again, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Next on the agenda would be an update report on the distant tsunami watch. Again, we asked Emergency Manager Jenny Damaris to give us a quick update. And,
sure. Here's my email for you.
Okay, thank you. Welcome. Again.
Good morning again, Commissioners. Thanks for letting me share some time with you. So a little update from our exciting event that we had yesterday in the early morning hours. The Gulf of Alaska had a significant earthquake off of Kodiak, I think about 175 miles southeast. It was registered at a 7.9 earthquake initially, which activated a distant tsunami watch for us from NOAA and the National Weather Service. That information was disseminated through the regular processes through federal information to the state, our dispatch center. When we received notification through the Sheriff's Office leadership, a decision was made to activate our Lincoln Alerts mass notification system to notify the public that we were under a distant tsunami watch. We decided to go ahead and wake everyone up for multiple reasons. One, we don't know where family members live. So you may live in the tsunami inundation area, the distant zone, but perhaps the family that might assist you lives outside of that area. You might have property, a boat, in one of the marinas that you might be concerned about. You might travel or have a business in that distant tsunami zone. And so that was the reason why we made to activate the entire system for the whole county. And I would say on a positive note, of the multitude of calls that we have been taking yesterday, only a couple of people have indicated that they were not happy with being woken up with that information, or they actually asked to be removed from the system permanently for any notification. And that's fine. We have the capability to do that, and that is their choice. But on a positive note, most people have been very gracious about the fact that they were woken up. They understand the value of that information, even though it may not have affected them. Some people were, okay, I got one for the notice and then one for cancellation. I'm outside of the area. I wish there was a feature I could press one so I wouldn't receive any more information for this event. Our technology doesn't have that capability in the system, but it's actually something I'm going to suggest to our platform, which is Everbridge. Also want to remind the community members, redundancy is really best. So if you live in the distant tsunami County zone, you should have a NOAA alert radio. They went off just as like as they are supposed to notify those individuals in their homes or businesses that there was a tsunami watch for the Oregon coast. FEMA also has a preparedness app that you can download on your phone. No matter where you go in the United States, you can receive those alerts and warnings. You have to put the location, like Lincoln County, and then no matter where you're at, you're going to receive those type of immediate weather alerts. And then, of course, signing up for our Lincoln Alerts program. Our landline numbers are in the system, and then you have the ability to opt in if you have a cell phone number or you have multiple addresses that you want to receive information on. And that's really beneficial, especially for our senior populations that may be a little more vulnerable or have mobility issues, and they may need assistance with evacuation or just understanding what those messages are. So if you are a caregiver or a child of an individual, you can put your parents' address in your profile, so if something happens in their neighborhood, you too can receive that information at the same time that they receive it. So that's another great feature. Here's some interesting numbers. When we did our notification yesterday, early morning, we had about 15,000 registered residential 911 or landline numbers. We had about 7,700 business numbers, and here's where it gets really exciting. We had 6,456 opt-ins. That's kind of about where we've been since the eclipse event. We saw a nice growth during the eclipse event. But by 5 o'clock in the morning, that was the number at 5 o'clock in the morning, by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we had 7,447 people that had subscribed. But by 8 o'clock this morning, we had 7,851. So we have seen an increase of over 1,395 individuals creating their profile in the Lincoln Alerts program. That is, you just can't put a dollar or a value on how important it is. Yesterday, our division had phone calls nonstop. All like every 2 to 3 minutes, there was another call, because our community started talking to each other. Oh, you got a call? Did I get a call? Did my phone work? We did have a few issues that we're working on. But the real question is, wait, how come I didn't get a notice? Well, ma'am or sir, do you have only a cell phone? Well, yeah. How are you going to call me? How do you reach me? And so we had an overwhelming response of the community through grassroots, word of mouth, peer pressure, if you will, that you don't want to be left out. And, you know, in our logo on our materials is we can't alert you if we can't reach you. Now, one of the things that could have progressed that we have access to additional technology, had it been a warning and we needed to actually evacuate communities, a couple of other things would have went into place. We could have activated the emergency alert system, which goes across local public radio, and then the National Weather Service has that capability to do as well, so they would have activated it at their level and the television stations and everyone would be running that information automatically. We would also do door-to-door notification with our public safety officials. We held our conference call with public, which is in our unified response protocols. All of our agencies, public safety, law enforcement, we all have the same plan. So we had our conference call, and during that conference call, we actually received the cancellation. So that was a positive thing. But had it switched to a warning, those resources were already pre-staged, knew their focus areas of where they would need to evacuate in that distant tsunami zone, and they would begin making those processes happen.
So let me say something.
Yes, sir.
I got a phone call at like 2 minutes afterwards on my cell phone. Woke me up. Then I had like 6 phone calls in the next hours. And so I could watch the progress. So I didn't even, I could see it wasn't going to develop, in my opinion, from what was going on.
Right.
But the system worked great for me.
Yes.
What is unusual, and my suggestion is we need to have our people in their staff get information if they want to be on it. Because when I contact people in Salem, or people that are legislators and stuff, their staff wasn't on it. And they want to be on it too. So I think you're going to see a better communication inside of the government entities if we reach out to them. They were surprised. They said, "What do you mean you got all this information?" And they did. So I'm going to talk to them.
And so, and that would be an encouragement for the Office of Oregon Emergency Management. They don't have this capacity that we do. And if the state were to purchase this type of system, even for their own internal operations, they could add those group of people to be on the notifier list. One thing that we've done on our system, when you got notified multiple times because you are a commissioner, you got the citizen notification and then the public safety leadership. We have in our notification, ORS, Oregon Emergency Response, the duty officer, the Oregon Health Authority duty officer. We have the American Red Cross duty officer. All of our state and federal partners that are here locally, they're on there. Our Oregon Health Authority liaison person is there. They all get those notifications directly from us. They don't have to wait to receive. If something's happening in Lincoln County, they're getting it first. They're not waiting for another state agency to tell them something has happened in Lincoln County. Do you need to assist them? I bet you were probably the only county in the state that uses our system the way that we do.
Yeah. I was a long way. It worked great. I needed to know whether I needed to come to the office or go to wherever, and I could see it was progressing, so I waited for the next call, whether I needed to come.
Right.
And which were the instructions.
Yeah. Correct. And that was it. And we've had a few people with some feedback about, a little bit more information, but sometimes if you make your voice message too long, and that's why we referred them to go to the website, we referred them to listen to local public radio, because that's where we would be disseminating more information. But just a couple of after-action things that I think is important to mention. We did have a few anomalies on the South County area with Pioneer Telephone and our platform. It's actually three little issues. They've already been resolved, and we're probably going to do another test message either today or tomorrow at noon, and then to assure those residences that did have issues of not getting the first message but got the second one, that has been taken care of, and to show that to them. One of the things I would like to have for consideration is that we do a quarterly system-wide test every 3 months, maybe the first Monday of the month at noon. The reason why technology changes, even within our own platform, telephone companies change. I didn't realize that Charter has a whole nother prefix number, and we had a few issues with those. So if we were to do a quarterly test once, don't wake anybody up at night, then I can collect that data to make sure that as technology things changes and we can't see it, then we can actually be on top of it before we have a real issue.
Why wouldn't we just go ahead and initiate that process?
Well, so this is part of the after action. We just came up with this idea, like, we need to do this quarterly test. So it's not that I'm asking for permission, but I'm now, the people that are still, like, right now, Melinda in my office, we are still getting calls every 2 to 5 minutes. So we're asking them, hey, what would you like to have a quarterly test? And so far, everyone has been very positive. The other thing that we need to do is translate our Lincoln Alerts information. We don't have a Spanish version, so now that just got started this morning with the health department. They have the ability to be able to translate that, because I know our non-English speaking population confused what were their directions. The other piece we're going to need to look towards when we do send a mass notification, the first message may be English because we have to get it out the door, but then we're going to need to determine how to acquire a translator to repeat the same message quickly so that we can get that other message out. So we've got to do a little work around that. And the other one is 211. Through our 911 PSAP centers, people start calling them right away. They're not sure, am I in the zone? What should I do? And I think what we need to do is ensure that the 211 services out of Portland that we can contract with, that they have our distant tsunami plans and that information at their fingertips, and that on every message that we send out that's related to tsunamis or whatever, for more information, contact 211, and then they would be on our public safety leadership alert. They would automatically know, and then people would start getting pushed to them away from 911 services. So we have, even with this small event, there are some really critical and valuable after-action improvements that we can make on a short term.
Cool. Any other questions?
No. It sounds like we're heading in the right direction to get this thing really working.
I have one question for Ms. Damaris, and then I see Lieutenant Shanks has a comment. But so clarify for the public, this was a watch, and of course you mentioned the next step would be a warning. So what's the progression?
So it's information statement, watch, advisory. The advisory means something is coming, but it's only going to affect your immediate shoreline. And then the warning is that distant tsunami is expected to come far enough that will actually affect the public, requiring evacuations. Another thing to note, my understanding, the state of Washington only has one zone. So when you hear those alerts, the warning messages coming, it doesn't say distant. We put the word distant in there because we only need to evacuate the distant tsunami zone, not the local and the distant. Right. But because even the Pacific Northwest is not on the same page in regards to the zones, we have to kind of craft that message a little differently. The other piece, I just want to put it... vote in for this. These are our help okay signs. The grant monies came from the National Weather Service. We printed 10,000 first. We used them up quickly. We printed another 2,000 operationally. I'm almost out, so we're going to be adding more of these to our operational budget. They have the ready, set, go levels for people to understand what that means when you get an evacuation notice, and then the tsunami information, tsunami ready, to get that information. So more and more people are asking for these help okay signs, and it's a great resource for public safety when we have to do an evacuation. You put in your window, yep, I need help, I have a mobility issue, I don't have a car, I have a pet, or I'm okay, our family's good, we've already gone.
So I would just make one last observation. Commissioner Thompson apparently sleeps more lightly than I do, since I woke up at about 6 o'clock in the morning and said, oh, look at the alerts. So.
And so, Commissioner, do you have a landline at home?
No, I do not.
Yeah,
I have a NOAA radio.
Yeah.
My name over the cell phone.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, my cell phone was in a different room, and the NOAA radio was in the basement. So we're making some changes within the household there.
Yep.
But my wife would tell you I'd sleep through a train coming through the house. But anyhow.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great information. Nice to see that we've actually learned some things, and we've already made some corrective action.
Yep.
And we'll continue to do so. So good work, Lieutenant Shanks.
Thank you, Commissioners. Good morning. Again, I'm Adam Shanks. I'm your Administrative Lieutenant in the Sheriff's Office, and I also oversee and assist Jenny in the Emergency Management Department for the county. I just wanted to make two quick comments, first being commending Ms. Damaris for her efforts last night. When the time came that we needed to push the button and progress this forward, she went straight to action and kept everyone under control and communicated effectively with all of our partners. The second thing I wanted to say was there's a very, very collaborative effort from all of our partner agencies. I think within the first hour of that first message Jenny sent out, inside the EOC, we had 19 total people that came from around city and the county government, from the Sheriff's Office of the State Police to the Newport Police Department, Newport Fire, Board of Commissioners representation, and city county governments. Our conference call, we had
almost every single agency was accounted for, even the Siletz Tribe and the City of Siletz were on the line.
Literally. So I just wanted to make those comments that the system and what we've built and what Jenny has been able to do with emergency management and progress us forward, and with your assistance and commitment to this department and to the citizens of Lincoln County, it worked how it should, and it was a great thing to be a part of, and I'm proud of what we were able to do for our citizens in this situation.
I would certainly echo those comments.
Thank you.
Thank you. Keep
Thank
up
you.
The good work. I hope we don't have to do this too often, if at all.
We'll have to bring Taylor.
All right. That concludes those reports. Commissioner Hall, as I indicated, had the lead. Commissioner Thompson?
I expended my time right there.
Yeah, well, we've had some great reports. I have nothing to add. Constituent input. This is the opportunity for constituents to comment on any subject up to 5 minutes. I see nobody coming forward. Our next meeting of the Board of Commissioners will be held on Wednesday, January 31st, right here at 9:30 a.m. in Lincoln County Courthouse. And with that, we're adjourned.